We are recording.
You know, I can't roll my R's.
What?
Can't do it. I wish I could. If I could, I'd do it all the time.
Come on. You can't even
do it. I can't.
Now I feel like I have to flaunt it.
Just do it. Just keep saying alien resurrection.
Resurrection. Ripley.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the Horrid Halls of Academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And we are back to finish the final mission of the thing with the other thing. We are here to complete the quadrilogy that we began last episode with Alien and Aliens.
So if you haven't listened to that one yet, that might be a good starting point, but I believe that one of the findings that Alex and I have come up with this series is that the sequels of these films don't actually rely on their origin films.
No, and I think that's what makes them so special and so unique. And as a franchise, this is what differentiates Aliens so much from every other major franchise against any other genre. And I think that's why it'll be hard for us to kind of go on to a Nightmare on Elm Street or a Friday the 13th in the same manner, because they kind of rely on these similar tropes. Each film is great of those franchises, and they all have their special little things, but ultimately they're playing by their tropes so heavily. They rely on them so much. Now, I recently watched a video on YouTube, and we will link this in the notes of this episode, and it was absolutely fascinating because it's something that I've been thinking a lot about recently, and I think we've mentioned it a little bit on this podcast, but it's the idea of intertextuality and the idea of intertextuality gone wrong. So in this video, again, it will be linked in the episode notes, this person talks about the way franchises, particularly franchises like, let's say, Star Wars now with Force Awakens or Jurassic Park now with Jurassic World, rely on these standard tropes and these very specific scenes and these very specific callbacks to elicit an emotional response. And instead of building on that, they actually cling to those to create an entire narrative and an entire drama in the film, rather than taking risks and maybe failing, but maybe also really succeeding by trying something really, really new. I think for these two films that we're talking about today, Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection, they're not generally received as the most beloved of the franchise. That was reserved for the first two films. But I refuse to ignore these two films. I think each one presents a different special idea of what this battle is.
I totally agree with that. And even with the first two films, we discussed how tonally unique they are. Totally different directors with totally different styles, putting different emphases on different aspects of the films. And Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection are no exception to that. So without further ado, let's take on David Fincher's Alien 3.
Was there an alien on board?
Yes.
There's definitely something in here with us.
We have no weapons of any kind.
Start.
It's here!
Hey,
fire starts aboard the Sulaco escape pod, which is carrying Ripley, Hicks, Newt, and Bishop while they are in stasis, causing the ship to crash land on the prison planet Fury 161. Only Ripley survives and finds evidence that a facehugger was aboard the ship. The guards on Fury 161 alert Weyland-Yutani that a woman has landed on their planet and that she needs to be evacuated. Meanwhile, the facehugger has attached itself to a prisoner's dog, unleashing a xenomorph with dog-like properties. The xenomorph begins attacking and killing prisoners and guards alike, but seemingly leaves Ripley alone. Ripley and the remaining prisoners and guards team up to kill the xenomorph, while Ripley learns she is carrying a xenomorph herself. Working together, they do eventually manage to destroy the xenomorph as a crew from Weyland-Yutani arrives, led by a man who looks identical to the android Bishop. He claims to be his creator and that he will protect Ripley. He explains that Ripley is carrying a queen embryo and that they'll remove it from Ripley, promising her a life that she has not yet been able to truly have. Ripley, not trusting the corporation in any way, kills herself rather than let the queen embryo be weaponized.
Boom.
Yeah, it's not a happy, clappy film, guys. This isn't, you know, a film with a lot of laughs. It is deeply embedded to its time of the 1992 release that it had. It's nihilistic to the extreme. It's a hard watch in a lot of ways.
I also feel like this film is really unfairly maligned. And we're going to get into it that there was absolute production chaos within this film, as in so many films that we discuss on this podcast. But basically, David Fincher has essentially disowned this film. This film was his directorial debut. He's had a huge career since then with Seven, Fight Club, Gone Girl, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And he took the reins after another version with Vincent Ward directing was canceled well into pre-production.
There were so many different parts to the moving beast that would become Alien 3. As Andrea mentioned, the Vince Ward production was already well into pre-production, but there was also an even earlier draft with Rennie Harlan coming on board, who had at that point just directed, I think really, Nightmare on Elm Street 4. And this was going to be about how Weyland-Yutani sought to weaponize the aliens and really explore a political mandate behind the whole thing. And then when you get to Vincent Ward actually leaving the film because 20th Century Fox got really cold feet, worrying that it would be a really weird, arty-farty film, Vince Ward just turned it down. He refused to cooperate and left. They brought in David Fincher very quickly to fix it. So what wound up happening was the original producers of the film wound up working on the script. Fincher had some input, and they redesigned the whole thing, but essentially keeping this idea of these maligned figures on this isolated planet who had a really deep religious leaning. So a lot of the pre-production stuff that a lot of fans have fallen in love with is this concept of the wooden planet, which is something Vincent Ward developed. And then when David Fincher came on board, it was basically like he brought the set from the Madonna Express Yourself video, which he also directed.
Fincher has so vocally disowned this film. He has stated that he hates the final product, and he says that nobody hates it more than him. He was involved with several disputes with 20th Century Fox over the script, over the budget. He claims the producers didn't trust him entirely and were looking over his shoulder the entire time. And as a result, he was not involved with the 2003 Assembly Cut, which is also known as the Producer's Cut, which came out in the Quadrilogy set. He flat out refused to appear in the Quadrilogy set. He was the only director of the franchise to disown his film to that extent. And as a result, I didn't get a nice Fincher intro in my extended cut when I watched it. Now, the Assembly Cut adds about 20 minutes to the film, but it also removes previous portions, and it changes the film quite drastically, expanding on major plot points. And one thing that I always hear about this film is, you don't like it? Well, have you seen the Assembly Cut? You can't quite fairly judge it until you've seen the Assembly Cut. And it's weird because it's not the director's cut. The Assembly Cut was overseen by the guy who directed all the making of documentaries and who produced the Quadrilogy set. And his name is Charles de Lazarica. Now, Fincher considered overseeing the cut, but he gave De Lazarica his blessing when he decided not to. De Lazarica tried to restore Fincher's original work print before Fox cut it up. The additional scenes had poor sound, however. You could tell where the extra scenes were sewn in. But in 2010, for the Blu-ray re-release that I have, several cast members actually came back to re-record their dialogue in the additional scenes. So the newest version actually sounds much better and a lot more seamless. Now, the assembly cut, as I mentioned, was much better received than the original version, causing a mass reevaluation among critics. And so just real quick to give a couple of examples of the most important scenes that were added in. We have the alien gestating in an ox rather than in the dog Spike.
I really like that addition. I think it's so much more medieval in a way. The dog thing always felt a little odd to me, and even watching the initial theatrical cut, it's a very strange moment when there's just this dog roaming around. But I love the idea because the ox is part of, you know, tilling the land and working the planet, whatever's left of it. And I love that callback to a medieval or feudal kind of system. I thought that was really cool, and it just added an interesting texture that isn't there when you just have like a fucking dog.
Well, that's right. And an ox is also such a stupid workhorse of an animal. Like, when you think of an animal that is just kind of a host to parasites that just lives upon its instinct, whereas a dog is a pet. And so it has a bit of a different connotation, but I was into that change. In addition, the EEV wreckage evacuation is extended. In the assembly cut, Ripley is found washed up on the beach. And in the original cut, she was pulled from the wreckage. There's also a lot more emphasis on the prisoner's religion, which I think is so great. We're going to get into it shortly, but that is really the crux of this film, I feel. The prisoners successfully trap the alien until Golic fucks it up in the assembly cut. And also, supporting characters get a lot more development, especially Golic and especially Aaron, also known by his IQ of 85.
What's this 85 thing?
A couple of us sneaked a look at his personnel file the day he arrived. It's his IQ.
It's such a funny thing to see those edits added back in, because those two characters who Andrea just mentioned are probably two of my favorite actors, simply because of a little movie they were both in called With Nail and I, which is a cult British comedy film from the 80s. It's amazing if you have not seen it. If you like dry British humor, gosh, you cannot do better than that, in my opinion. Those two actors who I love, and I love seeing them in things, and that's one of my biggest complaints about Alien 3, is you've got, you know, these group of men, these prisoners who have adopted a kind of really intense religious line, and outside of a character like Dylan, who's played by Charles S. Dutton, they're almost indistinguishable from each other. It's funny, when I was listening back to our first episode and Andrea mentioning how she felt all the Marines kind of became like one another, which is a fair enough point, but I felt like it was that to the extreme in Alien 3, especially within the theatrical cut.
Well, that's right. And everyone having a shaved head and wearing the same thing doesn't help.
And those sweet, sweet British teeth.
So once again, this film was a disaster of people getting hired, working a bit on it, and then leaving, which is why the film seems unbalanced and kind of cobbled together. In addition to the studio meddling, it made the set very miserable, and that comes through kind of effectively, actually. This isn't a pleasant environment. It's very bleak. It's very hopeless. People are just putting in the time to get through it, not unlike being in prison. There was also a very misleading teaser trailer for this film, featuring an alien egg emanating light from a crack above what looks an awful lot like Earth.
Alien 3 would become one of the first really big examples of something that is common practice these days, especially within Hollywood, coming out with a release date before the film. And this got mentioned a little bit in the Never Sleep Again Nightmare on Elm Street documentary, where they were talking about how they would develop poster art before actually developing a script. And that usually happens when a film company recognizes that they have a really successful property and they are just really excited, or very money hungry, however you want to look at it. They will go on and on to get the audience excited. You will see this now even more when you have teaser trailers for teaser trailers against the actual trailer. It's really insidious how much this happens. I think the notion coming off of Aliens is that aliens obviously got bigger than Alien. More people, more xenomorphs, more firepower. The whole thing is crazy. The next big thing it seemed to be was like, okay, well, then it should happen on Earth. Something should happen on Earth. We have to bring it back home. And Alien 3, through all of these rewrites, through all of these problems, actually winds up resembling Alien far more than any other film in the franchise or any other ripoff film of this kind.
That's right. And coming back to watching it, I was watching it and I felt like it was too long and occasionally really boring. I felt myself not quite enjoying it while I watched it, but I found myself very affected by some powerful moments that stick out in my mind. And I love films that are like that, films that are so smart that you don't notice how smart they are until you're thinking about them in retrospect.
Yes, this film offers a lot of subtleties and a lot of things that offer a different context to the proceedings that we've seen before. So it's a film that a lot of people have hung a lot of things onto because there is a lot of bleakness and a lot of nihilism, as I've already mentioned, but that offers itself up to a lot of different interpretations and a lot of different ways to read the film. And I think that's what we're going to get into now.
That's actually a really great segue into one thing that really got fans worked up about this film is killing off Newt, Bishop, and Hicks. Fans were really pissed off about that. But in my opinion, their early deaths actually undo one of the bigger pitfalls of Aliens. Aliens ended on a very happy-go-lucky note, as we discussed in the last episode. You've got the happy family nuclear unit of mom, dad, zany uncle, as Alex explained, and then a child escaping. But I feel like their deaths really had a positive impact on Ripley, because by now, this alien has robbed her of her actual daughter and her makeshift Sulaco family, and now she's stuck in a fucking men's prison. Like, it really does up the misery and the torment of this poor woman. And so her battle against both the alien species and Weyland-Yutani is that much more personal, which is evidenced in her saying,
"You've been in my life so long, I can't remember anything else."
I think Alien 3 truly solidifies that this franchise is about Ripley. It is about Ripley in all of these stages of her life. And that is what makes it so exciting, especially to watch as a woman. Now, for me, and looking back on Alien 3, what the deaths of Newt and Hicks and Bishop does, even though Bishop comes back a little bit, and we're going to talk about him soon, I promise, is it truly proves the power of what Ripley is up against. She is up against the perfect organism, as was called in the first film, these xenomorphs who will destroy anything and everything, even one getting loose, is cause for pure panic. And on top of that, this corporation which seeks to capture it and capture her. So what essentially the Alien series represents, especially within Alien 3, is the undoing of all of our social constructs. They mean nothing. So in the first one, Ripley was up against this one alien with her counterparts, and they all fell by the wayside. In the second one, she got a nuclear family, and then at the beginning of the third, that nuclear family is taken away from her. There is truly nothing left in this life that this organism will not touch and will not destroy.
That's right. It really returns to Alien's main concept, as Alex was saying before. We've got a single alien set upon an unarmed crew, and nobody is safe. In fact, on this compound, there's even less technology or comfort than the first film. There's no self-destruct sequence that they can ignite. There's no shuttle. There's no weapons. And indeed, her own crew isn't exactly what I would call trustworthy.
Well, except for one. There is one inmate who seems a little more special than the rest of the inmates. A little more sponge-worthy, if you will.
So you think you're sponge-worthy?
Yes, I think I'm sponge-worthy. I think I'm very sponge-worthy.
So the character of Clemens is introduced very early on, and it's portrayed by an actor by the name of Charles Dance. If he seems very familiar to anyone out there who maybe isn't just a big BBC drama nerd like I am, he actually apparently plays a pretty prominent part in Game of Thrones. So there's that.
Burn the villages, burn the farms. Let them know what it means to choose the wrong side.
So Clemens is the doctor. That is how he is presented to Ripley. He is kind of seemingly part of the guard staff. And Ripley is almost immediately attracted to him. And for me, that attraction comes from the fact that he treats her with respect. He listens to her. And most importantly, he seems to believe her and stick up for her. He's very present in the way that she needs him to be present. And in the midst of them kind of getting to know each other, Ripley pretty much straight up propositions him for sex.
I've been out here a long time.
So they boink. They do their thing, and it's seemingly loving and respectful, and it's all good. And then Clemens dies horribly. It's one of the first big deaths in the film. And it's really heartbreaking because it's such a great performance. He's such a warm presence on screen. And you really feel like he is going to help Ripley. He might not make it to the end, but he's going to help her. He's going to be her ally. And the fact that he bites it so quickly, and his death is actually, you barely see it because the alien grabs him from behind, wrapping him in a shower curtain. So his death becomes invisible to us. It's almost like this thing that didn't happen. And in the midst of their kind of post-coital bliss, Clemens reveals to her that he was actually a prisoner on this planet, and he has stayed on as a kind of monitored doctor character because he feels like he hasn't fully done his time, that he needs to do more.
Right. And that idea of penance, that idea of I could leave this alone, but I have dues to pay. And that's kind of something that I feel like keeps coming up with Ripley, where she could hide out, man. She doesn't have to fight the aliens every time she fights the aliens, but it's personal and it's up to her and she wants to. She voluntarily enters into this fight again and again because she has to finish it. Now, her relationship with Clemens is so clinical to me. Like, they're always deflecting each other's questions, if not just flat out lying to each other or being very evasive. And I love that conversation that you just mentioned where he comments how direct she is because she's asking him if he thinks she's attractive. That's almost the only time that she's really been direct with him. That was at the end of a whole conversation of deflection. I also love how after they screw, he presses her for more details about what happened to her, and then she asks him if it's because she's in his bed.
And now that I'm in your cot, you think I owe you an answer?
He says no, that she owes him an answer, regardless of where they are. And I really love that because I felt like it reinforced the fact that their sex, their relationship, their attraction, it isn't manipulative or coercive. It's sincere and it's comfortable. And they're both living with such pain and shame and regret and bitterness that when they eventually share, they're very much their own people. And their relationship seems oddly perfect and functional, which I think is why his death is that much more jarring.
Well, it's one of the things we keep talking about here on this podcast with feminism is it's about equality. And if you want to look at a relationship based in equality, even for a brief period of time in genre film, I don't know if you could do a lot better than Ripley and Clemens. Because it's quite profound how simple it is to do, but when they get it so right, I definitely react to that relationship each time I see it because it feels so genuine.
That's right. After the last episode that we recorded, we have seen some awesome memes and artwork taking up our what would Ripley do kind of idea. And so there you have it, listeners. That's the answer. What would Ripley do? Clemens.
And then for anyone who wants to be a really good partner, maybe think, what would Clemens do?
Really appreciate your affections.
I have to say, I haven't seen Clemens recognized very much as a real standout character in this film, but I will say that when I was watching my copy of the quadrilogy, there were a few producers commenting, and the making of Alien 3 is fascinating, so I highly recommend watching the whole thing if you have the time and if you're interested. But one of the producers actually mentioned that he really regretted not fighting to have Clemens around for a few more scenes, that like Charles Dance was such a great guy to have on set. He was so professional. They all worked so well together. And it just would have been nice to up that emotional ante a bit. Like, could you imagine if Clemens had to do something at the climax? That would have been really cool. But again, I am so glad for the way that relationship exists as it does.
Another thing about Clemens is that he really is the only one on her side in this film. In the previous films, you can see her kind of gradually taking on a position of leadership and people start to trust her. In Aliens, when shit hits the fan, she's the only one who knows what's going on and she kind of wins people onto her side. Whereas the prison context in Alien 3 is just so hostile to her continuously. So when Clemens dies, I'm just scared for her, frankly.
And I also think the relationship with Clemens is so interesting because it's one of the few times you really get to see Ripley's sexuality explored. She has been through hell and back, but she's down. She's down for it. And, you know, we even see the camera sexualizing her a little bit even before she sleeps with Clemens, showering by herself. We are aware of her body. We are aware of her sexuality. We are aware of what her body is capable and ready for. So I think it makes everything that kind of follows even that much more intense.
That's right. I really appreciated how they constructed her visually. I felt like she was really stripped of all the panty nonsense we talked about in the last episode between the shaved head and the gross bleary eye that she has in the beginning. Like, she's not presented as this beauty queen, even though she's still super hot. Like, she looks like the survivor that she is. She looks like the hell that she's been through. In retrospect, I think Alien 3 is possibly my favorite permutation of Ripley. She's down, but she's not out. She has learned from everything that's happened in the first two films, and we see her practice what she's learned. We see her exercise that new knowledge. Like, she comes up with cholera because she knows they won't believe her. I love that she didn't naively be like, no, there's an alien. It's like, no, she's damaged from all that. I love that she's far less concerned with saving everyone else in this film. In fact, at one point, she shuts a door on a prisoner being chased by a xenomorph, and she shows no remorse at hearing him scream. And I feel like this is actually her evolution as a leader, and like, not to bring up Game of Thrones again, but there's a lot of talk about leadership and what it takes to be a leader. And you want to be a compassionate leader, but at the same time, you have to make these hard decisions, and people die, and shit goes down. And when she discovers that she is host to an alien, she just wants to stick it to Weyland Yutani so hard, and she wins in most glorious fashion.
I think Alien 3 does a really excellent job of stripping away the kind of final girl stuff that had built Ripley up over the last two films. The final girl trope, as we have talked about on this podcast many times, is a figure really developed from slasher films that has, on occasion, been applied to Ripley. And it's, you know, that's, I believe that. She is a lone woman. She survives these horrific events. She tries to do the best she can. These are all kind of the real tent poles of the final girl without getting into too much of the nitty gritty. And at the end of this, it is her doing away with it. It is not about self-preservation. It is about a bigger survival that does not involve her. It's incredibly powerful to watch because it is such a new narrative that we see for a female character, and one that I'm really having a hard time thinking of another example of.
And I feel like she is so tested in this film. She's especially tested at the end when we revisit Bishop, when Bishop's creator, who I guess it's Michael Weyland. I guess we kind of discover that in subsequent sequels.
Oh, well, this is like a linchpin of internet discussion forums, which I delve deep, guys. I went down that rabbit hole a little bit. So the first appearance of Bishop that we have is Ripley fishing him out of a dumpster, essentially, on Fury 161. And she has this heartbreaking discussion as she tries to get more information from Bishop by quickly reconnecting him.
How are you? I like your new haircut.
And it's heartbreaking because Bishop One is truly, I think, a window to her current humanity, one that inevitably wants to end itself. When Bishop talks about his pain about wanting to have it over because he will never be top of the line again, that's, you know, Ripley's not worried about never being top of the line again. She's more concerned about ending these horrific events. But in that moment, she chooses to end this android's life and, to a certain degree, her friend's life. And so she notices that death is not a coward's way out. It is not something that is bad or something that should be feared necessarily. We obviously all want to survive, but sometimes it's not worth it.
That's right, and it's something that comes full circle in the end when she meets Bishop's creator, who bears his image exactly, which is supposed to be unnerving. It's supposed to be unnerving to her. Like, you can imagine in this context of waking up in this horrible fucking hellhole and then seeing not only a familiar face, but the face of somebody who was your friend, somebody who saved your life, somebody whose life you saved. And he tries to talk her into coming back with the company. And this is such a great moment where we see her shift apprehensions about androids and post-humanism that we talked about in the last episode. It all comes full circle to the point where flesh or synthetic, the enemy is anyone who is aligned with the company. And it's a really dark realization that hits her right before she makes that sacrifice. And I think it's so interesting that Bishop says, you know, I'm never going to be quite up to snuff again. And then in the assembly cut, you've got Wayland bringing a scientist in to say, hey, listen, we can take this embryo out of you and you can still have children. You can live normally again. You can recover from this and still be in peak form. And she realizes that no matter what, the company can't win whatever prize they dangle in front of her.
Yes, essentially the company is offering her the illusion of humanity. Even if they somehow contained this queen alien for their trip home or wherever they were going, she was always going to have to live with that knowledge of what happened to that. And it's such a trying thing to understand your own humanity and understand what you will give up, if only to be appeased. Like, you know, she's lost her daughter essentially two times over now. She's lost two partners now, and she's already lost Bishop once, and she's almost losing him again by him showing up in this visage. And there was some conjecture of whether, and he's credited as Bishop 2 in the credits of Alien 3, the bishop who shows up at the end. He gets hit in the head and you don't see any blood, so there was conjecture of if he was also an android. And in the assembly cut and in Lance Henriksen's many convention appearances, he has elaborated that, yes, there was blood. I believe he was real. David Fincher felt he was real, so he was a real person. And then if you're someone like me who considers Alien versus Predator canon, I have no qualms with that movie. I think it's really fucking fun. And there's a lot worse ways to spend like 89 minutes of your life. In that film, it actually begins with Waylon, as played by Lance Henriksen, as an old man dying on his way to search for this final big quest. And a predator offs him as they become entwined with this predator versus xenomorph battle. Now, you can look at it in many different ways. Maybe Bishop 2 in Alien 3 is an ancestor, a relative, or perhaps he is a clone. There are many possibilities, which the next film will elaborate on, but we're not going to get to that yet. What I do want to leave this thought on Bishop with is that Bishop's role in all of these films, I think, is one that serves to complicate humanity. And I think that is in large part due to having an actor like Lance Henriksen, who can play a wacky uncle, who can play a company man who's evil as fuck, and a befuddled old man who maybe wants to make his mark on the world. I think each of those things refracts a different part of humanity, and I don't want to discount any of those performances. So I like to think of them all as owing something to each other.
So insofar as Ripley is trapped on this godforsaken place, there are a whole bunch of people there who aren't trapped on it. We've got a bunch of prisoners, and it's revealed that the prison was actually dissolved, and these people decided to stay on as custodians. And it doesn't go much further into it than that, but that, for me, is plenty. The fact that they've developed this apocalyptic religion, we've already discussed on this podcast how religion can comfort the very desperate, and it's quite popular in prisons. It's quite popular for prisoners to rediscover Jesus and seek forgiveness and atonement. Now, these inmates have adopted a kind of ascetic Christianity. They've sworn an oath of celibacy, and they've shaved their heads for lice, supposedly, but it does make them appear even more monk-like. And it also makes them bear resemblance to skinheads, I couldn't help but think, like particularly by way of the occasional fist salute, and then, of course, by the barcode tattoos. Now, barcode tattoos are fairly common, and what's interesting is that people who have them tend to have quite polarized stances on their meaning. It's either a declaration of individuality, as in, we are all human, but my code is unique, I am one of many, but also one of a kind, or it can be used as an ironic anti-establishment statement, which is common among anarchists and punks. Now, the one factor that both meanings have in common is the idea that humanity is essentially manufactured, and the commodification of human beings is a big theme throughout this entire franchise. And this is just one of the ways in which I feel like people say that Alien 3 doesn't really fit with the rest of the films, but I feel like it brings it all full circle.
I 100% agree with that, because ultimately I think what Alien 3 tries to do is end these life cycles. They try to end them. And, you know, not only in prison does religion become a really huge factor, but also at the end of one's life, that's another huge moment when people find religion, that kind of finality that you want to believe in something more if you don't already. And I think for these prisoners, it makes their sacrifices or their deaths towards the end of the film less irrelevant. It makes them part of something bigger. It makes them part of a team. It makes them feel wanted and needed.
They're anticipating a second coming, like a liberation of sorts, and they're hoping that staying at this prison and being miserable will atone for their sins in the eyes of their God. And as Alex mentioned a minute ago, it's suspected that this savior is coming in the form of a xenomorph, but in the end, the savior slash destructor actually comes in the form of Ripley. Now, all of their religious purity is, of course, it looks really good on paper, because their vows don't seem to mean very much when some of them are confronted with the opportunity to rape Ripley. And this is a scene that we have to talk about, just because this is pretty classic rape culture, victim blamey type shit, and that as soon as she arrives at this prison, the superintendent is all up his own ass about, we can't have her parading around here, giving the prisoners ideas and tempting them. And, you know, I think Alex coined the iconic, men are not just dick havers, but these prisoners. Sex crazed dick havers. But this prison is positing its population as just, women are a piece of meat, and as soon as they could get their hands on them, they would. So when you're watching this film, you're like, oh, fuck, you know, that's such a fucked up thing to say. I really hope the superintendent is wrong. But sure enough, at first opportunity, when Ripley's alone, a bunch of inmates gang up on her and beat her and try to rape her. Now, at this point, Dylan saves her, but it's not even really to save her.
Take off. I gotta re-educate some of the brothers. We've gotta discuss some matters of the spirit.
It's more like he's saving his brothers from themselves. It isn't about her. Now, Dylan and Ripley have a really interesting antagonism right from the start. You know, early in the film, we have a funeral sequence where Ripley is just so aggrieved and she's totally at a loss for words. And here comes Dylan, who doesn't know her. He didn't know the people who died, and he's got these very powerful words about life and death and suffering and sacrifice.
We commit these bodies to the void with a glad heart.
And yet when Ripley tries to approach him in the context of friendship at the mess hall, Dylan is pretty much like, fuck off. And it's actually my favorite moment between the two of them is when he tells her, I'm a murderer and a rapist of women. And she replies,
well, I guess I must make you nervous.
She is essentially saying to him right to his face that the fact that he's a raping piece of shit is his problem and not hers. And that is such powerful stuff. And all of that lays the groundwork for Dylan coming to disrupt this rape, not to rescue her, because she is not his problem. It's the salvation of his brothers that are his problem. And I thought that was so badass.
And ultimately, the relationship between Dylan and Ripley and the rest of the inmates, even the ones who attempt to rape her, is one where she doesn't fight to gain their respect. They learn to respect her. And it's pretty damn powerful when you think of it in those terms, and if you can view it in those terms, because she's not doing or saying anything that's too fucking crazy. They actually have to rise to her level, and she helps organize them and do everything. And when she learns that she is carrying this xenomorph embryo, she asks Dylan to kill her, and with all the subtlety that David Fincher can muster, he has her lie against these barred walls, Christ-like, with her arms outstretched, until Dylan says,
"I want to get this thing, and I need you to do it. And if it won't kill you, then maybe that helps us fight it. Otherwise, fuck you."
Dylan realizes that he and his brothers are unsafe without her. They need her. And if there's any hope of survival, it will be through her.
I also feel like Dylan's resemblance to Malcolm X isn't an accident. He just reminded me of him throughout. A very powerful and passionate speaker, a very deeply religious man. But Malcolm X, he wasn't a writer. He didn't have writings apart from his bibliography. It's his moving speeches that contained all his philosophy, and it's his speeches that we still talk about today. Now, when it comes to the demise of the superintendent, when chaos and anarchy is actually presented to the prison, Ripley straight up approaches him to lead, and he declines. He's not a leader in tactical military terms. He is a spiritual guide. He can rouse the rabble, but he won't command it, and that's really something that he handed to her. And so when he refuses to kill her, he's like, listen, this is on you. I'm not going to do your dirty work for you. And that was how I interpreted it. I also picked up on, and did you pick up on, the biological imperative of men being biologically unable to control their sexual impulses? I thought it was cool that they keep referring to the prison as being double Y chromosome, double Y chromo. Like, it's not a men's facility, not a male's facility. It's not a masculine facility. They stripped it right down to biology.
Yes, and it feeds into the whole notion of the Alien franchise and trying to elevate it. And I think that's why it makes sense that the quote-unquote nuclear family at the beginning was destroyed in favor of these carnal needs and carnal desires. And it's a carnal need when Ripley wants to sleep with Clement and he consents and they do it and it's great. And then when Ripley screams and fights back when she is attempted to be raped. But then it even goes further into a survival instinct when they're all fighting to survive and they're working with people they may not want to work with in order to figure it out and get off this damn rock.
That's right, and that's actually a great point. Another one of the additions that the assembly cut made to the film was a really quick moment. It is so brief, but it is so powerful that it sticks out in my mind. It's when they're all working together and they're devising a plan to trap the alien, and at one point, Ripley just meets the eyes of her attempted rapist, and they have a moment where they look at each other, and the camera just holds on them for a second. It's just enough to know that you know they saw each other, and you know they remembered what happened, but at that moment, it's just a total inversion of the power structure where, when it comes down to it, there is no male and female. There is no sexual power imbalance. There's no patriarchy. There is only survival. And shortly thereafter, that same inmate actually sacrifices himself. And I do feel like it was a very brief, retributive atonement at the very end that, you know what? She's in charge. I saw her as a piece of meat, and now she's saving us all. I am the piece of meat. I'm done.
Well, isn't that what every character in this film comes to realize, that it is about the greater collective of humanity and not about themselves? I think that is what religion aspires to. I think at our best, that is what us as individuals aspire to do. And I have to say that as a female viewer of film, a lot of films, I don't know if respect is the right word, but I am slightly in awe of the way this film portrays sexual violence and the aftermath of a potential sexual violence and assault, because it is not, you know, string violins playing and this music rising and her crying on a stand somewhere that she got assaulted, which is, that is not to take away from anyone's experience, but it portrays it in a way that is so matter of fact. It's a little cold. It's a little clinical, but it portrays a reality of it in such brutal terms. And it's really quite affecting in the way it tries not to be manipulative.
I totally agree with that. I feel like as a female horror fan, I'm almost always defending the genre. I'm always defending these depictions of women getting hacked up by murderers and women getting raped a lot. And so violence against women isn't necessarily misogynistic depicted in horror movies. There's a way to do it well. There's a way to make it a plot device that is meaningful and that matters and that's not exploitative. And that is a line that so many filmmakers can't seem to see, but it was executed really well in here.
I know, and I feel like it was almost an accident because of all the studio interference, and I'm sure David Fincher had feelings about it, and the writers had feelings about it, I'm sure Sigourney Weaver had feelings about it, and I think you have to chalk it up to a little bit of a happy accident.
Now, before we wrap up, I want to make the briefest mention of Aaron, also known as 85. You know, he's not a huge character. The assembly cut gave him a little bit more airtime, and in that little bit more airtime, it gave me a couple of things to think about. Among which, the fact that the inmates, they really like to go on about how stupid he is. But he demonstrates his stupidity in these really subtle and human ways. His disdain of the prisoner's belief system, for example, but most of all, his loyalty to the company. And it's actually kind of ironic. I feel like it's supposed to be an intended juxtaposition of, you guys are ridiculous for believing in your God. I believe in this company. And who is more harmful? Who is more destructive? He doesn't believe in salvation, but he thinks the company, who has never replied to any of their transmissions and has never given a single solitary fuck about them until now, will save them. And he really has to confront that reality, and he does.
This character exhibits so much pathos. It's such an incredible performance. Again, it's an actor I love. But, you know, he's constantly mentioning his life outside of this planet. He's one of the few people who mentions, you know, his kids and, you know, he's got to get back to them. And so when his ultimate sacrifice comes at the end, like, I'm not going to lie, guys, like a couple weeks ago when I rewatched this and then the assembly cut, I got kind of choked up. Like, it really meant something to me. And that's, I think, why I can imagine Clemens' death meaning more if he'd lasted a bit longer. But in Aaron's case, we knew what he was giving up by doing this. He was also coming around to the quote-unquote Ripley way of thinking, the Bishop way of thinking, that yes, he really wants to see his kids. Yes, he wants to get back to his nice, normal, manageable life. But something much, much bigger is at play. And from the one xenomorph he saw, it was worth his life. And if that doesn't move you, I don't know what will.
So one final thought on this is the one last change from the theatrical version to the assembly cut that we haven't discussed yet. In the theatrical version, the alien queen embryo actually bursts forth from Ripley's chest as she's falling. And in the assembly cut, she dies intact. What's your read on that?
My read on that is that in the assembly cut, which I choose to believe is Fincher's vision and version of the film, it completes Ripley's Christ-like death. It creates all of these things, but it might also make you wonder what exactly was in her. It leaves a little bit open, up to discussion, up to thought. But I think it is the more quote-unquote artistic choice in this. It allows Ripley to have her moment fully and completely. We view her in her final frames on her own, as we have always been wont to view her. In the theatrical cut, which was done in reshoots, where the embryo bursts forth from her chest and she goes from having her arms outstretched to pulling the embryo in so she's sure it dies with her, represents to me 20th Century Fox's belief in the icon of the alien. It feels very marketing. It feels a little bit titillating. It feels like the final transgression on Ripley's body. This was the rape that didn't happen before that is now happening. And it's, especially if you've already seen the assembly cut or about to see the assembly cut, it's so different to watch this thing come out of her. And I don't love it.
Totally agree. See that? I knew she would do that, guys. And that is our discussion of Alien 3. And in my personal opinion, this film really wraps everything up so nicely. The ending had a really nice, tragic, bleak finality to it. And even the logo, if you've seen the logo for it, it's got a xenomorph kind of in a circular. Everything comes full circle, and that's very visual throughout the advertising of this. But the franchise did not end there. I read a review of Alien Resurrection refer to it as almost an appendix or an addendum to this complete trilogy, and I thought that was really apt, and that's what we're going to get into next, guys. 1997's Alien Resurrection.
These were very, very hard to come by.
So was our cargo. Whatever you got going on here ain't exactly approved by Congress.
It's a military operation.
Really?
Who are you?
Ripley Ellen, Lieutenant First Class, number 36706.
Ellen Ripley died 200 years ago. You're a thing, a construct. They grew you in a lab.
What the hell is going on here?
He is breeding an alien species.
I wish you could understand what we're trying to do here.
Now they brought it out of you.
Not all the way.
You want to tell us what this is?
It's a queen. She'll breed. You'll die.
Ellen Ripley died trying to wipe the species out. I'm not anxious to see her taking up her old hobby.
Feel it. I can hear it moving.
So he, like, ran into these things before.
Yeah.
What did you do?
I died. We're moving.
That's a standard emergency procedure.
Any serious problem in the ship autopilots back to home base.
What's home base?
Earth.
What is that?
So in Alien Resurrection, we're 202 years after the events of Alien 3, where Ripley finally stuck it to the man in most glorious fashion by killing herself and the alien queen embryo inside her. Now, instead of Weyland-Yutani, we've got another group of scientists after the alien, and they've been able to clone Ripley with the embryo still inside her. They extract the queen embryo, raise it, and get a bunch of eggs. Now, they also decide to hold on to the Ripley clone almost as an afterthought because her DNA got mixed together with the alien in the cloning process, giving her some alien characteristics such as acid blood and a proclivity to sniff things, but also Ripley characteristics, including some of Ripley's memories. Now, the scientists hire mercenaries to deliver a top-secret cargo to their ship, which turns out to be human beings in stasis for the purpose of incubating more aliens. While the mercenaries are aboard, the aliens escape and start killing everyone. So the mercenaries team up with Ripley to survive the xenomorphs and also to derail the ship's course back to Earth. Now, within this main plot, there's a bunch of other stuff going on, including the fact that one of the mercenaries is revealed to be an android who was aware of the experiments and actually came aboard with the intention of murdering Ripley and fucking everything up. They also encounter a new kind of alien-human hybrid known as the Newborn, because the alien queen they pulled out of Ripley's clone has some of her human characteristics, including a womb. This alien follows the group back to the mercenary's ship, where Ripley tearfully destroys it. In the end, the Ripley clone, as well as the android and a couple of the mercenaries, make it back to Earth, where the science vessel crash lands and they contemplate what's next. So, we're not going to pull punches in this podcast. We never have, and we're not going to start now. This movie is not good, but it is also really fascinating. It's fascinating to see the strong talents involved combine to make such a mess. Like, some good things just don't mix well. And this film is a bunch of very opposing visions that didn't mesh together well at all.
Well, I don't know if they combine so much as they're at odds with each other. So I think the two main creative forces we have to talk about when we talk about Alien Resurrection are the screenwriter, which is Joss Whedon, who you might know from a little TV show called Buffy the Vampire Slayer or the Avenger movie or any other many things that he has done, including another sci-fi drama called Firefly.
Joss Whedon was hired to write the screenplay, but of course, in typical Alien sequel fashion, the studio really fucked with him. And you know that I love Whedon, but even he admits that he was kinda in over his head here. The studio wanted the movie to center around a Newt clone instead of Ripley, so Whedon wrote a 30-page treatment on this idea before being informed that the studio changed their mind. And now they want to base the story on a Ripley clone, which must have been a huge narrative hurdle for Whedon. And then he had to shoehorn in Winona Ryder in some meaningful way because she was under contract to appear. Now, Sigourney Weaver wasn't into the idea of returning at first, but she liked Whedon's script and she liked the idea of Ripley's loyalties being in question vis-a-vis the humans or the aliens.
I assume she also really liked the paycheck, which I have read in multiple sources across the internet was $11 million for a woman in 1997. That's a huge payday, even by today's standards. So that money's pretty hard to turn down, I imagine.
It's true, but I also do get the sense that Sigourney Weaver really cares about this franchise. I feel like she's very cognizant of the feminist elements and how female fans have gravitated to Ripley. I think she really does care. So in addition to commanding that kind of paycheck, she did want some creative control. She wanted to make sure that this was a meaningful sequel, which I'm not quite sure they pulled off. But Whedon is obviously very unhappy with the final product. I was watching the Making of documentary this morning, and it's hilarious because he is so young and he is just so green. And he claims that they said his lines, but they said them wrong. And it wasn't that they changed the script. They just executed it in such, quote, a ghastly fashion as to render it almost unwatchable. Now, we've talked about Joss Whedon at length in this podcast already. We've done episodes on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, as well as Cabin in the Woods, with which he was involved, and he has a very particular kind of deadpan comedy dialogue that when it's executed well, I love it, but even in shows like Buffy that I love, there's always some players who don't quite pull it off, and it just seems all kinds of wrong. I get it, I love his humor, but it really relies on the players and the execution. I also really got the sense that Whedon was a huge fan of the franchise, and he really did want to make a good, worthwhile movie, but his vision and sense of humor didn't gel with the director, who doesn't appear to have an emotional attachment to this franchise at all. It seems like he just came and got his paycheck.
And so the director, or shall we say auteur, for Alien Resurrection was one Jean-Pierre Jeunet. So a French director, fresh from France, who spoke no English or very little English, so on set he had to work with a translator. Now, Jeunet was particularly popular in France and within indie Hollywood circles with his first two films, Delicatessen and City of Lost Children, two highly praised, highly beloved films. And if we've seen anything in this entire franchise, it's that what better way to add legitimacy to a project and get your money's worth by hiring a young director who still has something to prove. So I think that's what Fox did. He agreed to it. Everything is fine. Everything is copacetic. And then in the milieu of doing this whole film and the press for it, eventually Jeunet decided that he no longer wanted anything to do with Hollywood. He'd had enough. He'd seen behind the curtain, so to speak, and he returned to France to make one of the most popular French films of the new millennium, a little film called Amélie.
That's right. And in the special features, Jeanne describes being bewildered that they approached him to direct this film, being bewildered and very flattered. And he was approached after such highly creative filmmakers as Danny Boyle, Peter Jackson was approached, Brian Singer. They were all tapped to direct, but it went to Jeanne, and he accepted the project with a budget of $70 million. And he really brought his team aboard. He was promised by 20th Century Fox that he would have full creative control, but he had to stay within budget and he had to stick with Joss Whedon's script, which the studio at the time liked and Sigourney Weaver had accepted. So he couldn't quite fuck with that.
And I think, as Andrea has already mentioned, something that's super important to Joss Whedon's writing is understanding every piece of tonality that goes with it. It's almost like if anyone's really familiar with Shakespeare, and you know that Shakespeare writes in iambic pentameter, which is a like da 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 da. It's a very systemic rhythm which permeates all of his writing. And I think Whedon has the same thing, and I don't think that's a bad thing. But I think that's why when Whedon himself directs or is heavily involved in the creative process, these things get pulled off really well. And when they're passed off to someone else, it just, to be honest, it all gets lost in the translation.
It's also worth mentioning that this was the first movie that Jeanne had ever directed that he didn't write himself. And that's quite significant for someone like him. In contrast to the special editions of the first two films, when Jeanne introduces the special edition, he stresses that it's not his director's cut. The theatrical cut was his cut of the film, but the 2003 special edition added some opening and closing sequences that he had planned that were too expensive, and so they were cut, but they were added back into the special edition, and he almost seems kind of dismissive, like, I don't know why they did it again, but here it is. Now, the special edition does add 13 minutes of added footage. Deleted scenes include some references to Newt. We've got Ripley waking up in the middle of her operation, an extended conversation in the mess hall that explains that Weyland-Yutani was bought out by Walmart, and the reveal that Earth is now toast, which we'll return to shortly.
So the only way I can truly make sense of Alien Resurrection is through the lens of a black comedy. That is what several people have associated with this film. Some of the creators have also put that label on this film. It's very wacky. It's very absurd. The whole notion of absurdity has to do with calling out things that are seemingly wrong with the present situation. So Ripley as a clone whacking off all these one-liners constantly is absolutely bizarre to the Ripley we have known and come to bond with through the first three films. Now she is like this odd action star, and it makes a little bit of sense when you look at the context of 1997. In 1997, if anyone remembers, we were in the heyday of like Michael Bay and Jerry Bruckheimer and Con Air and boom, boom, boom. It made sense to have Ripley spout off those one-liners. But through the lost translation from Joss Whedon's script to Jean-Pierre Jeunet's direction to Sigourney Weaver's status as an older character actress, it's very odd to watch, and a lot of it doesn't land. So you're kind of having all these half laughs at this film, and you're not sure if you're laughing with it or laughing against it. You know, again, with the fact that, you know, Ripley has been this hard-boiled, amazingly rendered female character, and then this one, she's showing up again with the one-liners and a manicure. And it's so odd to watch, let alone her actually, which Sigourney Weaver did, sink that basketball shot. It's so weird. And one of the things that I came to when thinking about this film, again, through that lens of a black comedy, was the notion of a farce. Now, the farce play has been around really since the 17th century. It started in Italy, and then it very quickly migrated to France. The word farce actually comes from French, which has to do with wording for stuffing or padding. And these stories initially were very slapstick, had to do with commedia dell'arte, an Italian theater form, and they had a lot to do with social status and how does one climb social status, how does one overcome social barriers. And then as these plays took firm root in France, they developed their own kind of French farce, and you see this a lot with a playwright like Molière. And within French farce, they deviated from the slapstick and into more of a verbal, witty repartee. It was a lot about one-upping each other linguistically and through rapier wit. So I think you kind of have Jean-Pierre Jeunet taking his theatrical interpretation of Joss Whedon's script to this really heightened level where it's quite odd to watch, but I feel like under several different lenses, if you can piece them all together, you might have a cohesive vision.
I almost wish this film could have an assembly cut. I almost wish this film could have a do-over because it sucks and I feel like it's such a crying shame. Now, Joss Whedon is very politically progressive. He's very vocally feminist. And so the mommy issues that we see emerge in this film, Whedon tiptoes around them. They are subtle. They are latent. They are layers to be peeled back here, which is, of course, what this podcast is for. Among these themes that we want to talk about, I love how the scientists tell the Ripley clone that she's going to make them all proud. There are a lot of instances in this film where a clone of something is considered its mother, and something that came from something else is considered its mother. This film has a weird way of redefining motherhood, as it's not something that necessarily nourishes you or raises you or teaches you right from wrong. It's just that from which you were spawned. And it's a very basic and biological term that's quite cold, frankly. Now, the alien queen that came out of Ripley's clone has a womb as the result of the genetic mixture, but this is a wee bit confusing because this same queen produced the eggs that the scientists used on the humans that the mercenaries brought over, right?
You're thinking way harder about this film than anyone involved in the production thought about it.
Anyway, Ripley has this weird psychic bond with the alien queen, presumably because she carried it. And to be fair, the aliens did exhibit a kind of hive mind with the queen in previous films. As such, the alien queen in this film is sorta Ripley's misplaced daughter, but oddly, she doesn't seem to have any emotional attachment to it. Ripley does form emotional attachments to a very limited set of characters. We see her exhibit sadness at the memory of Newt. We see her exhibit strong empathy and horror when she encounters the failed clone attempts that are all mangled. She's horrified when one of them begs her to kill it, but she complies.
Kill.
I think some of the strongest visual imagery in this film has to come from that clone scene. Obviously, when you watch the film, you're introduced to the clones quite early on. They're some of the first images you see, and then you see the perfect or fully rendered version of Ripley presented to you almost as the first shots. And then when Ripley and the makeshift crew of the Betty discover all the abominations that have stemmed from these experiments, including the one that is still kind of alive and begs Ripley for death, it's not only truly traumatizing as a viewer, but it also delves into a lot of really interesting themes, which this film doesn't seem to have the resources to tackle. I think we deal with allusions to the Uncanny Valley in some of this, the notion of something that looks like Ripley but isn't Ripley, and it's horrifying to us. I think it also, as Andrea also mentioned, it delves into this idea of posthumanism and this idea of humanity and also alienism as being malleable. They are things that are constantly in flux. So right now in our society and within our popular culture, we're dealing and learning more about gender as a fluid way of life. And this film is trying to present a radicality where it's not only a gender thing, but it's also a species thing, which is pretty mind-blowing in a lot of ways. And it's hinted at, but it's only hinted at as a plot device for Ripley. It's hinted at so she can show humanity when she has to kill a clone of herself. And then as Ripley connects to the hive mind of the alien, as Andrea was just mentioning, so she's gaining special access, which allows them to evade this alien infestation.
Ripley also has an emotional attachment to the newborn, who came from Ripley's daughter, the alien queen's womb. Which, again, it's really weird to me because Ripley doesn't give much of a fuck about the queen who literally came out of her body. It's the next generation that she bonds with. It's the newborn. And the newborn also rejects the alien queen who just gave birth to him by killing her. Now, the newborn is somehow even more hybridized than the Ripley clone or the queen that she gave birth to. And that's something of a mystery, too. You would think the newborn would have less of Ripley's DNA than the queen she carried, right? Like, unless the queen mated with a human, I was thinking maybe that doctor played by Brad Dourif?
Well, Andrea, if you'd like to hear my crazy theory.
Would I?
What if the newborn's daddy, quote unquote, is Clemens?
I love it.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense if you look at the newborn's anger at the alien queen and its love for Ripley. So it's Clemens as lover and child trying to be like, I still love you, Ripley.
Okay, I'm tweeting Joss Whedon right now. We're confirming this.
Also copyright Alex West, 2016. So outside of my brilliant theories about the parentage of the newborn, I also wanted to elaborate a little bit on what I mentioned a bit about the French theater of the absurd, theater of farce. It's the notion of the grotesque. And again, this was developed in Europe. It also kind of comes from Italy, also kind of took its foundation in France. And the grotesque is generally defined as something that is comedically ugly. It is something that is horrifying, but also kind of endearing. The French use the term grotesque to talk quite a bit about the gargoyles that embed all of their buildings. You see this quite famously in the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. And it was the most perfect term I could think of when observing the newborn. It is part human. It is part alien. It is part everything else that has come before it. And it's that weird fleshy color. It's this thing that kind of has eyebrows that makes it seem like happy or sad or angry. And so you've got all these humanistic characteristics, but it ultimately serves as an agent of chaos, and it is still something that cannot be controlled. So even as it was weaponized further and as the DNA got further and further out of control, it still could not be contained, and it ultimately had to be destroyed. And I thought the way it was destroyed was so interesting because if anyone has not seen the film recently, they shoot part of the window in a spacecraft and the alien gets sucked out through its back. So it's kind of like an inside-out, sucked-out-ness. It's pretty gross. It's pretty weird. It's really upsetting, especially as the newborn is kind of reaching to Ripley as its mother to help it. And Ripley ultimately knows, or the clone of Ripley, knows that it ultimately has to let this thing die. It's such a complicated moment, and I think that's what Alien Resurrection is wrought with. A lot of complicated moments that aren't truly dealt with.
Or are dealt with slapstick comedy and absurdity and Frenchness.
What has two thumbs, one eye, a pink tongue, and screws like a god?
So the last character that Ripley seems to have a weird attachment to is Call, even though Call went there to kill her and makes several shitty and rather hypocritical remarks like, how can you live with yourself knowing what you are?
You're a thing, a construct. They grew you in a fucking lab.
You get the impression that Call is supposed to be another daughter figure for Ripley. They have a few things in common. They're not quite human, but they're both programmed to have a drive for empathy and the preservation of human life.
One of the things I thought was most interesting about Call is that, mainly like Ash from the first film, she goes throughout the majority of the film not being outed, quote-unquote, as an android. It is a kind of shocking reveal towards the end of the film after she is shot and seemingly dies, but then returns to save the remaining crew members and Ripley. Now, one of the things that is so unique to Call is the fact that another character identifies her as an android made by other androids.
You're an Auton. Robots designed by robots, right?
So we are going beyond the Asimovian theories of the robot or the android that we introduced in the last episode. This is an android built by robots designed to be more human because that is what they wanted to be. That was something they gravitated towards. They wanted to have legitimate feelings. They wanted to not just be programmed to respond to people in a certain way. They wanted to legitimately generate those feelings. And I thought that was so interesting. Again, something very quickly glossed over in this film, but it really deals with the concept of humanity and what makes humanity. And that's a huge part of this film, where the people who are seemingly inhuman represent the most humanistic needs. And that can be anything from a xenomorph to Bishop, the actual android, or to Call.
And it's also something that Call and Ripley have in common, right? And again, this is something that's kind of glossed over, but in real life, the purpose of cloning is essentially to improve upon the human condition, right? We want to be able to clone organs that are cancer-free for us to transplant. We want to augment the human race. And so Call really represents that, and that's something that she and Ripley share.
They're striving towards the ideal of being a human when I think just through striving, they have actually achieved it. It's such an interesting thing to think about when you are trying to do the best. You probably are your best. And it's strange when they don't really come to that realization on their own, but they're left to survive and essentially rebuild something. We don't know what, but they're left to continue.
And in terms of survival, we're presented with Call and Ripley as the final girls of this film, essentially. I mean, Vreese and Jonner should have survived as well, but the ending doesn't show them. It only shows Call and Ripley looking out onto a post-apocalyptic Earth, and they have a really brief but really interesting conversation. We've got Call saying things like, "What do we do now?" which implies that they're a team, and it assumes that their futures are intertwined. You've got Ripley saying, "I'm a stranger here myself," implying that they share the circumstance of being non-human on a non-human planet. Now, the special edition of the film reveals that they are in a ruined version of Paris. You see the Eiffel Tower in crumbles, and Earth is totally fucked. The planet is barren, and neither of them seem surprised. So it begs the question, why were they so desperate to protect a planet in that condition? Answer me, Joss. Tweet back.
Well, from what I've learned from the production history is, and this was something that started with Alien 3, was there was always a sense to get to another planet. Earth was constantly in the rotation. There was also the sense of, like, do they go and find the xenomorph planet where all the xenomorphs are? Those things always played into the production of both Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection. Now, in the initial drafts of the script, Joss Whedon had the final confrontation with the newborn set on Earth. It was going to be something like Ripley was fighting the newborn and Call got on a thrasher and, like, thrashed the newborn to death. And I think what everyone ultimately wanted was to see what would happen when the xenomorphs landed on Earth, when it wasn't a remote thing, when there were people there to deal with it and how they failed at dealing with it. Now, I know there are comic series that deal with this as well that kind of have different history than the films, especially with Newt and Hicks alive dealing with it. But I think this was ultimately the purpose of a little film called Alien vs. Predator Requiem. The first Alien vs. Predator takes place in the Antarctic, and this safe place where these aliens could fight each other and deal with humanity in their own way. But in Requiem, they are in the middle of small town America. And the way this battle spills out beyond the small town and the way the government tries to contain it, I think that's maybe the closest we'll get to a cinematic version of it, especially now with this Prometheus sequel happening.
So we can't ostensibly talk about a film in the Alien franchise without talking about gender. But what I feel like Alien Resurrection accomplishes so well is the idea of a gender fluidity or a genderlessness, the way Alex was describing a little bit earlier. Now, I came across a scholar named Robert Wood who wrote an essay called The Implications of Generic Hybridization. And it's every bit as exciting as it sounds, listeners, but really interesting ideas. He argues that Alien Resurrection is trying to break from the rest of the franchise by removing the gender war aspect. There are male mercenaries and female mercenaries and male scientists and female scientists. And in both cases, the men are in charge, but oh well. And the central conflict of the film is about forming alliances across genetic boundaries. It's not man versus woman. It's not even human versus alien. It's about all the shades of gray that are represented in Clone Ripley, Android Call, and the intersex and interspecies newborn. Now, the newborn is really murky in terms of gender. He was written as genderless, and so Genet decided that he should be hermaphrodite. He should have male and female genitalia. And so he did. And it was a super expensive animatronic puppet that required 9 people to operate, and it had a very explicit vulva and a very explicit penis between the vulva lips. And in the end, even Genet had to admit that the genitals were just too much, so they wiped it out in the final edit with CGI, which obscures so much of the creature's glory. I mean, that's why people say that the newborn looked ridiculous. It might not be entirely why, but I have seen an image of the newborn with both sets of genitals, and I will post it in the episode notes on the website. The mercenary men all talk a big game in terms of sexual prowess. There's a lot of sexual jokes, but they're all talk. Even Elgin and Hillard, who are a couple, and they make a bunch of sexual innuendo with each other. And, you know, Elgin talks about how fuckable Call is to General Perez.
She is severely fuckable, ain't she?
But when Elgin and Hillard are shown being intimate, he's rubbing her feet, which is pretty much the most subservient physical sexual contact that a couple can have. And that felt really Whedon-y to me.
The way that scene was shot is so misleading, but in kind of a delightful way, because it focuses on her pleasure first. You see her face enjoying it, and the camera very slowly pans back. So you're like, oh, what is he doing to her? What is it? Like, is he eating her out? Is he going from behind? Like, what is it? And it's just massaging her feet.
Now, there was an area where gender does take the forefront, but in a way that I couldn't really make sense of. The fact that the ship's computer has gone from being called Mother to Father.
Yes, I think that is one of the first things that truly struck me about this film was the father reference. When Call asks Father to do something, it's, you know, a million alarm bells were going off in my head. And my only thought with this was that was the attempt by the filmmakers and maybe the studio, partially maybe a clever nod, but also an attempt to wrap it up, because there is a sense of, where is the father figure? Is the father figure Weyland-Yutani? Where is it? But for me, the essential essence of father versus mother is that you're just fucked constantly in this universe. You only have yourself to depend on. So it's that ultimate nail in the coffin of nihilism in this universe.
There's also the idea of an absent father, right? Like, mother played such a big role in the first two films, and then here we have father who is not really doing much.
And the main kind of antagonist outside of Weyland-Yutani always is posited as the alien queen. It's a thing that can reproduce, but who is impregnating the alien queen? And it's a very female systemic reproductive system, essentially, as far as I can understand it. And so the notion of having a father, that absentee father that Andrea just mentioned, who is impotent in his responsibilities. So that's it almost seemingly for the Alien franchise. We mentioned Prometheus in our last episode. No one really took us up on the challenge. So either you're all kind of appreciating it quietly, which we appreciate ourselves, or you've also kind of written it off. And as we mentioned last episode, the sequel to Prometheus, now called Alien Covenant, is in pre-production or shooting now. I've seen some photos and we've posted some on social media and they frankly look pretty dumb. But who knows? Who knows? We may all be wrong. And we've also mentioned Neil Blomkamp's proposed Alien remake after the second one, which really to me is the total emblem of the idea that I started this podcast with in this episode of the manipulative intertextuality. And I'm not excited for that. I'm much happier to have this franchise with Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection. And you know what, guys? I am not angry at Alien vs. Predator or Alien vs. Predator Requiem. I watched them both in the last couple weeks. They're not great films, but they're damn fun. And I think they actually add some elements to these films that weren't properly explored, either due to issues from 20th Century Fox, from producers, from directors, from visionaries. So you have a little bit more explanation of how the Xenomorphs came to be on people's radar in Alien vs. Predator. And then you can actually see a very dark version, physically dark because they light it so badly in Alien vs. Predator Requiem, of what a xenomorph outbreak would look like on Earth. So all those little questions I had or wanted to see, I feel like they were kind of realized. So as a fan, I'm pretty happy to leave this franchise. I feel satiated enough with it. Emotionally, I felt satiated with the third one. I felt like that was a great ending. And then I feel like Alien Resurrection and the Alien vs. Predator films are just fun tangents.
I totally agree with that. And having watched the entire franchise over the space of a couple of weeks to record these two episodes, it actually feels like four amazing storytellers writing each a chapter of the same story. And I frankly wouldn't have it any other way. We see so many franchises that desperately scramble for new voices and they just religiously attach themselves to the original filmmakers, hoping that they can make lightning strike twice. And it just doesn't work that way. And I think the Alien franchise will endure as a set of four movies, some which are more beloved than others, but they all speak to the same universe in their own unique voice. And I hope we did it justice, listeners. We are really excited to record this two-parter, but we have a lot of great ideas for future episodes in store.
Well, before I tell everyone about July, I do want to say we get so many great suggestions from listeners. So if you're wanting to request something, you can tweet us, you can Facebook us, you can email us at info@facultyofhorror.com. Andrea and I have a super sexy shared Google Doc. We add everything to it when we can. And then we just cycle through all the ideas that you guys have, our own plus yours. So much great content that we have, I think, for years to come. But for July, currently, we are in the Rue Morgue vault. It is so hot in here, and it is June. So in July, guys, it's just gonna get fucking hotter. And the only way I can think to get it hotter is with two little films that remind me of summer so much.
We're gonna be looking at Fright Night and The Lost Boys. We've got two summer blockbuster vampire flicks that are largely concerned with teens. You know, not to assume that our listeners are the same age as us, but I hope that these titles just inspire the same nostalgia, the same idea of carefree youth bubblegum horror movies, and we're really excited to sink our fangs into them, so to speak.
So that is your super fun, we hope, homework for July for next month. Rewatch Fright Night, rewatch Lost Boys. I have not seen the remake of Fright Night, but I will probably watch it for this. So that could factor into it. I could see that happening. And a couple announcements before we leave you. My book is out. So if anyone doesn't know, it's a book I wrote via McFarlane Press. It's called Films of the New French Extremity, Visceral Horror and National Identity, forwarded by one Miss Andrea Subisati.
Who?
It is full of the art house movement of new French extremity films like Trouble Every Day, Irreversible, 29 Palms, and into the horror movement of new French extremity with films like High Tension, Calvaire, Martyrs, Inside, and many more. So if you've pre-ordered it, it should probably be in your hot little hands by now. If you're gonna buy it, that's super rad. I hope you do. Let me know what you think. I spent most of last year working on it, so it's my baby. It's my newborn. It's out in the world. I hope I don't have to send it collapsing in on itself into space.
And if you guys want a signed copy, we've gotten a couple of emails and a couple of tweets about, hey, I bought a book and I want to get it signed. We can try to help. So do send us an email if that's something that you want to do. We will do what we can because we're obviously very excited. And congratulations, Alex. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for writing the foreword. It was so lovely to have that. So that basically wraps us up. That's Alien done. Questions, comments, complaints, you know how to hit us up. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're on Reddit. You can get us via email. I'm sure if there's something else you'd like to do, we'll figure it out and we'll be in touch because we want to keep talking to you guys. And if you like what we do, hopefully only if you like what we do, it would be such a big help if you did a review on iTunes. That helps us, helps the show. It's free to do. It takes a little bit of time. 5 stars only.
That's right, guys. Rate us on iTunes and express yourself. Because until next time,
office hours are closed.